Well, I just did, you're curious. Okay.
You're all set.
All right, thanks. Good. Okay, well, glad to see you all. Welcome. And I'm Deb Irwin, and I'm a medical anthropologist, and I'm in the Department of Cancer Prevention and Control. Our current chair now is Dr. Ambrosoni. So, and then Dr. Rodriguez is there with me. And we're both in the Office of Cancer Health Disparities Research. So we have a combination of duties with community engagement for services and outreach and things, plus the research programs that we maintain, so for the Cancer Center Support Grant. Anyway, so we're going to talk about disparities. This feels very awkward to me because it's kind of like you have all these people come in with this one view, you know, 1.5 hours, whatever, time to get a topic in, and it feels a little incomplete, but hopefully we'll introduce enough that you'll kind of get an idea of what we're about and how this fits in, whether you're a clinician or a basic scientist. And by the way, we're getting ready to do some kind of little training program and linkage of advocates in the community and basic and clinical scientists for research projects, because whether, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but the Department of Defense, the DOD grants, all of the PCORI grants all require advocates to be involved in the development of research and in the conducting of it. So if that's of interest to you, or you're going to be applying for a DOD grant, this may be something that it'll be sent out by Judith Epstein, and we'll look forward to having folks involved. We're going to try to pair advocates that are interested in the type of research that the scientists are doing and get them together and knowing each other before they have to actually put a grant in. So today we're going to try to increase your understanding of, this looks like it's too high, the meaning and complexity of cancer disparities, and increase the understanding of efforts. So we're going to give you some examples of what the disparities are, particularly in Western New York, and many of those apply nationally. And then some of the research that's being done actually right here at Roswell to address some of these. Yeah, the title on this, Marie, I think I need to move this down. So I don't know how we do that. But what's that supposed to say?
Maybe it's the definition.
It's what?
Disparity.
Yeah, can you read it? Yeah, y'all can read it. But it would be good to have this back. I don't have maybe I can take a copy of this and I'll know what the title is. So the this is one of the definitions for disparities in terms of the differences in incidence, prevalence, mortality, burden of cancer, and related adverse health conditions that exist. So this is a pretty generic title. No, it's still that way. But it gives you kind of an idea. And these differences can be based on multiple things. So looking at this, it can be related to race, it can be gender, it can be age, various things, various causes. For example, you have more cancer in older people than you have in younger people, and those kind of things. So that's a disparity as well. This is the demographics for Western New York, and we've got about 1.5 million people in the area, and of that, only about 10% are actually African American. There's 18% that are some other kind of non-white minority, and out of that 18%, 10% are African American. In Erie County, it's higher, and we have about 4% Hispanic, 13% African American, and then a total of about 22% non-white that could be considered minority. And that also includes a growing group out of the 2010 actually census. The greatest increase were in mixed race categories, and in Asian populations. So that's related to a lot of the refugee immigrant populations we've had. Then in Buffalo, the city, we actually have about 50-50 non-white minorities, and within that, the highest number is about 40% African American. So although the population in Buffalo and Erie County has had a bit of a population decline, although it seems to have kind of evened out, and I think over the last few years they've been reporting it evened out, we have had an increase in minority populations. So if people have left, it's been primarily whites that have left. So this is kind of the population base that, for example, the Cancer Center bases its comparison on for how are we doing in terms of representation of patients to Roswell. And most particularly, for those of you who are clinicians and working on clinical studies, et cetera, is that it's very important for us to maintain adequate representation of minorities in clinical studies. So the other big issue for disparities, and I think this is one of the greatest influences on health outcomes, on access to health care that we talk about, is related to this poverty level. And we have, as you can see, when you go down to the Buffalo level, it's really almost about 30% poverty level. This probably needs to be updated. But it's even high for the overall area because we do have a lot of rural areas that are also quite poor. Now, how many of you all are from Western New York? Oh, quite a few. Buffalo itself, many people from Buffalo? Okay, a couple. And then rural areas, like county area? Okay, all right, several areas around. All right. So in terms of measuring and trying to assess disparities or factors that influence disparities, we kind of are limited. So we have certain things that we can look at. For example, we have a self-report system. In fact, we just had a discussion this morning in our journal club in the department about race and ethnicity. And this is oftentimes used as a proxy for a lot of things. Like we'll say African-American, and I'm going to give you some examples of that in terms of with lower survival rates, et cetera. And it's really a combination of things. It's really not just the race or ethnicity of a population, but it's all of these other things, particularly some of the cultural context and the income and the education. But it's hard to measure these others because we have race ethnicity in the medical record. It's in the EMR. It's in the database that we use for the DBVR, et cetera. And age is in there, obviously. Geographic location, your zip code, those kind of things. Insurance status is in there. But we don't have things like income. We don't collect any SES. We don't collect any of the socioeconomic variables that are so important to health outcomes in the patients that we see, and none of the hospitals in the area do. So you don't have that. It's not available. And we certainly don't have any of the cultural context other than if someone speaks another language. So it's a very significant problem to try to measure this. So when we look at this overview of disparities, blacks, African Americans, this is very just generic. This is giving you a big picture kind of view of this. Are more likely to be diagnosed with cancer. The age-adjusted total cancer mortality is higher. They're less likely to be diagnosed at an early stage, also much less likely to survive 5 years or longer, and in many cases have much poor screening rates. So there's any number of issues in here that one can point to in determining what it is or which disparity or how much of this is actually behavioral, economic, other things, or even biological or genetic. And of course, that's a lot of the molecular epi studies that we do. We're trying to look at maybe some of the underlying genetic problems that are creating these disparities, and there are some. But in terms of race, ethnicity, that's not really a biological construct, and it's oftentimes a proxy for something else. Okay, so in terms of breast cancer incidence by race, this is the old data, 1996 to 2001, and as you can see, you're more likely to get it as you get older, and this is the African-American black line, and this is the whites, and the incidence rate after about age 40 begins to change, or had begun to change, for more whites than African-Americans, although the mortality rate was still much higher for African-Americans. But now, we have just last 2 months, this came out in the journal, DeSantis article in CA, Cancer Journal for Clinicians, and this showed, now that says 2014, that's not right, this must not be the right reference, but it's showing a progressive decrease. This is the African-American line, this is the white, and the white incidence rate seems to be dropping a little bit, but the African-American is rising up to meet it, so that's not good news. This is American Indian, Alaska Native, Asian, and Hispanic populations down here, and they're still lower. And this is over time, so you can see this is 1975 here and 2010. Then when we look, this is kind of hard to see, and I don't know if this shows up well at all in here. Oh, let's see. Oh, no, you can't see it hardly at all in here. But this is particularly interesting because one of the things that it shows here is when you look at the younger ages, and you can barely see that. So this thing is projecting too high, so you can't, it's up there on the top of this curtain. But anyway, these are the younger ages. These are like, is this 30? Yeah, 30 to 49, 50 to 59, 60 to 69, and 70 plus. But in every one, it also has the African American are the red. So, no, but they're the blue. Where's the, I know that's on there. Oh, it's up at the top. You can't see it up at the top. But I know that the ER negative is the red, because the ER negative are the African Americans, and they have a higher incidence of ER negative cancer for every age group, which is a new kind of biological piece that we've added in the past 15 years, whereas the incidence for ER positive is still higher for white women, and then the overall. And one of the things to look at is when we look at, this is the death rates. This is from 75 to 2010. And they've been declining overall for everybody. But as you can see, the African American is not declining nearly as much. And there's a huge disparity. This is one of the largest disparities in cancer, is this mortality rate between African American and black women, and white women. And a lot of it is due, as you saw before, because the triple negative breast cancers, the ER negative breast cancers, are so much more aggressive. And why is that happening? So we'll talk a little bit about some of the findings on that. But one of the things that I want to point out is this little time period here, from 1976 to 1980, I think that is. That's kind of hard to read. And that's 85. So why was this death rate basically the same during this period of time for African American and white patients? Why did it just start separating out here in the 80s? Yeah. No, they were doing mammograms earlier than that. But the fact that they were, that might influence more of the incidence piece. But it could also influence survival, because if you can't find it early, you don't survive. What else was going on during that time period? About chemotherapy, adjuvant chemotherapy was just started back then. So this is kind of a historical artifact. But it was during this time that we really started the adjuvant breast cancer trials for breast cancer. And what happened during that is pretty evident by some of this evidence right here, and it hasn't corrected itself. So who were in those trials? Mostly white women. This is prior to the big push by NCI also and NIH to get minorities and children onto studies. So a lot of the people on the studies, a lot of the people benefiting, a lot of the people with health insurance, a lot of the people that were treated by physicians with adjuvant chemotherapy were white. And this starts really impacting this mortality line here, with the white women doing better and the African American not. Now, there also may have been happening during this time some of this increase of the triple negative breast cancers, but we don't know that, because you didn't know anything but just a single type of breast cancer back then. And so there could be some biological things going on in addition to that. And then with the tamoxifen studies, we've never really had enough African American women to do sub-analysis of that as to whether or not that really influences survival. So this is a very interesting aspect that could very well be mortality rate differences that are primarily related to social circumstances, not so much biology, but it could also be some biology. So, what is the title on this one? Oh, the challenges of eliminating. So the biggest issues that we have to deal with for trying to do away with these differences are socioeconomic status and poverty, which influences access to care. The race-ethnicity issue, which we're not sure how much of that is social context, how much of that is biology. The whole social context of SES, color, race, and health, and the biology and behavior. So this whole issue with poverty and health is kind of a chicken and egg problem. So does poverty cause a health disparity, or do you get sick and that creates the poverty? So poor health oftentimes does lead to multiple problems with this. We also have issues of proportional poverty and wealth. And the example I like to give about this, that there are differences, and there's a lot of economists that have done significant studies of wealth and proportional poverty, meaning if you are poor because you're a student, then that's kind of an acute poverty problem. It's not necessarily chronic. And if you were to get really sick, you have probably a family or somebody else to rely on to be able to kind of fall back on that. And that changes also with wealth. And there's a lot of discussion about that, even when many minority and classically underserved populations get education, begin to get really good jobs, but they don't have the deep pockets of what one would call wealth. And they also may have more poverty within the whole family. So even though they may be doing better, they may not really have that many more resources, because they may even have family members that are needing help as well. And so there's big differences that in terms of health and how you can take care of yourself and relate to all that. So race is frequently used, as I've mentioned, as a kind of an uncritical proxy. And there are also studies, this one by Gravely, non-Mulligan, that do test specific genetic or sociocultural hypotheses for competing explanations. One of the things he's done is he's done a lot of things with people's skin color and how the skin color becomes embodied in how people treat you, how you are treated, your perceptions of discrimination, et cetera, and how that can even influence biological problems like blood pressure. So I think, oh no, we still got the social justice issues. So, as can be expected, in terms of the race, social justice issues, social prejudice, racism, religious issues, boy, have we not seen that, the whole immigrant situation. This seems to, I've been teaching this for a couple of years, and I taught part of this in another kind of survey course, and it seems like every year this gets to be a more significant issue in the United States, and with the politics going on, we can certainly hear this in the media. But that's not necessarily something that people remember or think about. And this whole race and health issue is the fact that we have low income and education have been a major factor in not improving the health of poor people since the 1930s. So we're not doing a very good job in the United States of dealing with that. This is the one about social context and the issues of racial residential segregation and health. It's interesting, the whole Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus is beginning to change the neighborhood around here, and it's going to be curious to see how that's going to change the residential patterns of where people live, because depending on where you live in a neighborhood, you're going to be either, you may or may not have fresh vegetables, you may have only a corner store, you may have more liquor and tobacco products, you may have more of those things advertised in the places where you are. So there's also relationships of higher costs for housing, food, insurance, poor quality grocery items, targeted tobacco. And then the issue, another contextual issue, is discrimination and medical mistrust. And I find that I've had real challenges expressing to physicians, clinicians, and clinical providers of all kinds how strong this can be. But there are a lot of researchers. One, Terry Albrecht at Karmanos Cancer Center has been doing some really interesting research based on treatment decisions and how treatment decisions are influenced by the race of the patient and the race of the physician. And when there's discordant races, that oftentimes patients don't get the same treatment as a white patient will. So the idea that, oh, that doesn't really impact anything, and oh, it doesn't make any difference, is really not the truth. I think that the science of looking at some of these disparities and these properties and this whole medical mistrust, the other thing is, if folks have been treated a certain way multiple times, the expectation is that they will be treated that way again. So it's very challenging sometimes to build a good doctor-patient relationship if there's no trust there. So my call for you all is moving beyond the biomedical model on some of these things and recognizing these other issues. And then that pathways, how race becomes biology. This is the one by Gravely I was mentioning about the fact that skin color and depth of skin color can be influential in the embodiment of health problems. So Dr. Rodriguez is going to, do you want to go up there? You want this?
Yeah. This video is a little snippet of a larger documentary that was a series a few years ago. I think it was first released in 2008, called Unnatural Causes. PBS ran it, and then they have it available. Have any of you heard of it or seen it? It's a great documentary series, and even though it was a few years ago now, a lot of the topics that they're talking about and that they go over in the series are still very much issues that we talk about now in healthcare that you're hearing, you know, daily on the news, within the debate. So it's still timely even now.
There's one view of us as biological creatures, that we are determined by our genes, that what we see in our biology is somehow innately us because of who we were born to be. What that misses is that we grow up and develop. We grow up as children, we grow up as adults and continue. We interact constantly with the world in which we are engaged. That's the way in which our biology actually happens. We carry our history in our bodies. How could we not?
Living in America should be a ticket to good health. We have the highest gross national product in the world.
I'm very happy to finally have some of my cars in one location, some of them.
We spend $2 trillion per year on medical care. That's nearly half of all the health dollars spent in the world. But we've seen our statistics. We live shorter, often sicker lives than in any other industrialized country. We rank 30th in life expectancy.
Especially of economically developed countries, we are at the bottom of the list.
A higher percentage of our babies die in their first year of life than in Cuba, Slovenia, Estonia. How can this be? Is this just because 47 million of us have no health insurance?
Healthcare can deal with the diseases and illnesses, but a lack of healthcare is not the cause of illness and disease. It is like saying, since aspirin cures a fever, that the lack of aspirin must be the cause of the fever.
Or is it mostly because of our American diet and personal health behaviors?
Those behaviors themselves, in part, determined by economic status. And so our ability to avoid smoking and eat a healthy diet depends, in turn, on our access to income, education, and what we call the social determinants of health.
But wouldn't our genes trump social determinants of health?
Among twins who live together until age 18, who basically grew up in the same households, so had at least a relatively similar exposure. If they diverged later in life, if one became professional and the other was working class, they ended up with different health status as adults. This is among identical twins.
Written into our bodies is a lifetime of experience, shaped by social conditions and policies that can determine who will be sicker, who will die sooner.
There are ways in which our society is organized that are bad for our health. And there's no doubt that we could reconfigure ourselves in ways that would benefit our health.
There are huge inequalities in the society. All this wealth is maldistributed.
Pet food,
ice for the pets' water.
And I think that's in part why the U.S. as a whole has relatively poor health amongst the rich countries, and why even the better off people are suffering. And we think that that is not inevitable.
So even since this video, I wanted to check, you heard they said over $2 trillion on healthcare. So the latest stat on that from 2014 data is actually we're spending over $3 trillion, and that's with even the implementation of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, which was supposed to increase access to insurance coverage. But even though that increased access, it doesn't mean that everyone is covered. We know that there are still distinct and significant pockets of folks that are still uninsured. And as far as the U.S. rank, we were at 30, I think, in this video at the time. We're now 43, so we actually fell a little lower. The age did go up a little bit to 79.68 years for life expectancy, but we're still ranked below 43. So not necessarily getting better with some of these things. So what I'm going to talk to you about is kind of a culmination of things that picks up on what Dr. Irwin was talking about in terms of some of the race stuff, but then also thinking of factors at the individual level, thinking of things that have to do with genetics. We're here at a cancer center. We know that genetics is becoming more and more with sequencing and DNA and personalized medicine, a thing that we talk about in terms of cancer research and cancer therapies. It's not necessarily the greatest cause for developing cancer, but there are a lot of things happening around genetics. Then also health behaviors. Dr. O'Connor, your next lecture, he'll really go deep with that, but just thinking about what does this factor have to do with health outcomes and how that plays a role in terms of disparities, and then social determinants you heard mentioned in the video, which really has to do with things that are in our social and our physical environments. They can be exposures that we live in, we grow in, and we work in. So how can research help to eliminate disparities? Well, in our office, the Office of Cancer Health Disparities Research, one of the approaches or methodologies that we subscribe to and we use frequently is this approach called Community-Based Participatory Research, or CBPR. And so some of the studies that we've done are actually novel in the sense that we're using CBPR in terms of helping to translate some of the science that happens here and in innovative ways. And the example that I'll talk to you about today is a study that I had funded just a year ago, we wrapped up. And so that was actually working with more translational, so basic science that was happening here at the Institute, as well as some of the things that were happening in the Center for Personalized Medicine, and how CBPR was used as an approach to help bring that to the community level, so to translate. The other way that you talk about translational is when you hear folks talking about from the bench to the bedside. And so we're looking at taking it from the bench out to the community to have more community exposed to research as well as participate in research so that we can have that representation. It's a collaborative approach. It involves a researcher and then a community partner, stakeholder. It's action-oriented, meaning that the community is involved in the process actively. We're not just asking them to fill out surveys or donate, but also be a part of the research process. So research meetings, implementation, thinking about where we should recruit, how to go about that process, really be involved with vetting the actual research and how to go about doing that in a way that would be relevant to the community and the best way to get community involved, and so that you get people to buy into it. Also to address issues that are recognized by the community, so relevant to the community. Sometimes this is easier said than done. We know that with a lot of the funding mechanisms, priorities are already designated within the funding. So sometimes it's a process of what is funded and then how can we also address some of the things that the community would be interested in that could go along with the funding. So sometimes you have to be a little bit more creative with that. So the example that I'm going to talk about today is a project that we worked with the Database and Biorepository Bank here, the DBBR, as well as the Office of Cancer Health Disparities, and then folks in the Center for Personalized Medicine. So it was really across the Institute, a collaboration. We called the project, it started out as a pilot study that was funded by NCI that we did with the Hispanic community here in Buffalo that we referred to as Hoy y Mañana, which translates to today and tomorrow. And we opened up the study to then also include African American, Hispanic, and low income whites, but we were really focused on recruiting African American and Hispanics. And so this slide was actually something we worked with the marketing here at Roswell so that we could come up with something. We like to have logos for our study so that people can connect and, you know that this is part of the study and have kind of tie everything together. And it was also the logo that was used on the mobile van, which this is the van. I don't know if any of you have seen it around still. They take it out sometimes and use it, but it actually has basically the DBBR here is in a bricks and mortar, so it's inside of the hospital. There's a lab space. We needed to be able to recreate that same process to process the blood samples that were collected in the community on site, because in focus groups that we had done in previous research, we found that the community said, we'd be interested in participating, but we have issues getting to the institute, or we don't know where to go, or if you're here educating us at this community center, can't you collect our blood and we participate here on site? Scientifically, we had to think of how can we do that and then be able to offer the same sort of process that we do at the lab site. So this ended up being something that typically does not happen. The pilot study didn't pay for this, but we had funds through New York State for the Center for Personalized Medicine that allowed for the creation of this van that was literally a mobile lab. And so when you come up the back steps, you see there's a place for the community person to sit down, and there's a phlebotomy chair, and they can have their blood drawn. And then the rest of the area is literally the laboratory with the equipment that they can spin out and process those tubes and store them and bring them back here to Roswell. So our goal was to test these community-based approaches out in the community and pretty much see what was feasible and what would work. We did this two different ways. We did one with an education program and then one out in the community at health fair type events where there wasn't an education program, and we were just tabling at health fairs and asking folks, would you be interested in donating blood? And if they said yes and they, you know, were cancer-free or hadn't been treated for cancer in the past, they would then go and talk with the DBBR recruiters that would be much more in depth and go through the consent form with them. But they didn't participate in an education program in that aspect. So we were comparing how did that go. Overall, we ended up reaching about 370 participants in the community. And so we had about 264 of those that were involved in education programs, which we did in both Spanish and English. And then just over 100 that we reached through open events. And so there you see the breakdown of the education programs in Spanish and English and the open events. So what you can't see at the top of that table is that this is basically your demographics table, your table one, and this is for 311 of the cases that identified and had race and ethnicity data. And so we mostly encountered folks that spoke English. We did have a decent amount of our Hispanic population here is predominantly Puerto Rican on the west side of Buffalo, and they tend to be monolingual Spanish, so they're most comfortable speaking Spanish. And so in our office, our programs that we deliver and do outreach out in the community, we're always translating into Spanish. It's just a given that that's going to be what's needed. In terms of, we reach mostly females. Again, this is kind of an artifact of the work that we do through our office. We tend to reach a lot of women, and women are also health-seeking, but that doesn't mean that they can't bring it into the family. So it was actually an opportunity for us to test and do some programs that were just focused on reaching men, and we actually had a couple of programs where we had a solid male audience, but males are a little harder to reach in terms of health behaviors and health-seeking opportunities. And then in terms of age, we were able to reach older adults, which with most of you know with cancer, age is an important factor because your risk increases with age. So we did want to reach older folks. And so with education events, we really got more of the 60 plus. And with the open events, it makes sense that it was a little younger, that 40 to 59 years. African Americans, it was a 60-40 split with African Americans being more represented, but that's proportional with the communities here. African American population is a little higher than the Hispanic population. And then in the education, this is something interesting. I always like to point this out, and Dr. Irwin was speaking earlier about the importance of looking at socioeconomic factors, and you think about education, you think about income, and always making sure when you look at that data, a lot of times we have a tendency to talk about controlling for different factors. And you want to make sure you don't ever go jump to controlling for something without really looking at your data and seeing what the trends are you have before you make those decisions to take things out or leave them in. In terms of our population, if you look at education, the high school or less or the some college or higher, we have an even split there. It's 50-50. And so we had a decent amount that were represented that had college or better. And so that is something important to look at in terms of the data. You wouldn't want to over-control for that. The other thing was when we looked at the income data that we had for households, again, that's always a difficult item to get people to answer. You tend to have a lot of folks that skip. But for the ones that did answer that question, one of the things you have to take into context is thinking about the area and the economic history of this area. In Buffalo, there tends to be a very high proportion of jobs that pay $30,000 or less. And so you could have folks that are very educated, but they're not necessarily making great money. And there's not a lot of jobs that pay higher. And this is something that we've seen that's been a trend since the 1970s. We haven't seen a real jump in terms of salaries and of job availability. And so this is something important to think about. You don't want to assume that that low education and low income run together. And so with this population, we actually had a decent amount of folks that were well educated, but still living in poverty due to economic issues. And that's important to consider. And then in terms of biospecimen donation, we had over 36% in the education programs that participated, and then proportionally, the open events gathered more. And so we had to think about why was that. Dr. Irwin had an earlier pilot that she did in Niagara Falls that also showed that trend. And so with the education events, one of the things to consider is process. They're sitting in the education program, and then they have to wait in line to donate that blood. So it takes a little bit more time. Versus at open events, they can trickle in and trickle out and kind of donate at their convenience. If they don't want to wait in line, they can go to another table, get more information, and come back when the bus is, you know, empty. And so that's a little bit easier to get people through a little faster versus everyone at the same time once the education is over. So then in this table, we just see that, again, that higher education factored into biospecimen donation in terms of those with some college or higher did actually donate more compared to those with less education. And I can also tell you that in terms of willingness that we collected and looked at prior to looking at the actual donation piece, the same trend was there. We saw folks with more education being more willing as well. And so that makes sense in the sense that we're talking about a very complex topic of biospecimen donation, and it's also an altruistic act. And so the education factor, those with more education may be a little bit more easier to understand the concepts, the topics, what it is they're being asked to do, versus kind of less education, it may be a little bit more complicated and maybe less interesting in terms of wanting to participate in the research. And so what are the programmatic implications? So the community-based approach, one of the things that it helped do was increase capacity. In our office, we like to build on the partnerships that we have, and so with this project, we worked with existing partners that already had some familiarity with participating in cancer research, and then increasing their understanding of this new, little bit more complex topic that had to do with biospecimen donation. Transparency is important in terms of being very clear and very open about all of the steps, what's involved in the research process, what's being donated, how much is being donated, what's going to be done with the donations, how are those things stored, so that people don't feel that there's this mistrust that Dr. Irwin spoke about, or that something's being done and it's not on the up and up. Also, we had significant community ties prior to both of the program formats. Again, we were working with established partnerships, so this wasn't something that we just went out and said, oh, hey, we have this program. It's a lot of work to establish these relationships and to work in the community, and it's important that you really take the time to do that prior to trying to implement a research project or to recruit. You really need to build that foundation and gain that trust with your partners before you can even approach that step of participating in a research, especially something that you're asking people to donate something like a sample. And then both efforts require trained staff. So in our office, we have health educators that go out and deliver programs and do outreach in the community, but their comfort zone is much more of doing service programs and recruiting for screening. And so that's a very different animal than talking about biospecimens and how that has to do with cancer research and how those samples are stored and the science behind that. And so there was a lot of work that I had to do leading up to that to train our staff to be able to talk comfortably, understand the concepts, and then deliver that in a format that is in a lay language to the community. And then what are the impact on cancer health disparities? Well, we created this education program. This was not something that was previously available. We didn't have anything to talk about this. The pamphlet that NCI had put out was still very high level, kind of boring and dry, not something a community member, if we gave to them, would want to look at and really be interested in. And so this program was really much more tailored. We include examples that are happening here in Buffalo of research where other researchers at UB, Dr. Heather Ox-Balcom in her Jewels in Our Genes study, Dr. Irwin's going to tell you more detail about that in her, so I won't get into it, but it's a study that was based here in Buffalo so that they understand that there is a community relevance piece to this, and that's really important, especially working with minority communities. And that one of the focus was to increase participation from racial, ethnic, minority communities. And that's to be inclusive and also to increase representation. And so also to try to avert things like what we saw in the diagram earlier, where you saw that trend that Dr. Irwin pointed out, which was due to the adjuvant chemotherapy and folks not being represented in those trials. And so those discoveries were not working the same for all groups. We don't want to see that happen with personalized medicine or with the new advances that we're making. It'll make disparities that much worse. So we really need to think about our representation in those studies and who things actually work for, but then who was part of the study to begin with. And then built on existing community research partnerships to develop an innovative area. This is always something that we're talking about in research and that NCI looks for is innovation. How can we work with basic scientists, with clinicians, to really merge our fields and be able to work collaboratively together to do this team science approach? And the CBPR process helps. That provides that innovation. I think this goes back to you.
Deal with the disparities or improve the disparities. This first one has been going on for over 20 years now.
Did you have any questions? Dr. Rodriguez gave you a great overview of community-based participatory research and something that we're now using. Actually, Rodney Herring, Dr. Herring, who is an enrolled Seneca here on our staff, our faculty, is getting ready to and is working with Erwin Gelman on developing this same model, that same idea with the whole biospecimen banking. Rodney has done some initial discussions and some kind of a pilot study with Haudenosaunee, part of the otherwise known as Iroquois, it's a French term for Seneca Nation individuals, both cancer patients and others on that. And now they're looking, so he and Erwin Gelman are looking to try to expand this to actually do a larger biobanking study with the Haudenosaunee, looking at some genetic aspects for that. So giving you some examples. So I'm going to go through these. I'll go through them kind of quickly. If you have questions, you can ask me. But I just want to give you kind of an overview of some of the type of intervention research. So back in the day, 25 years ago, actually, the screening rates were even worse for African American than they are now. They had the issues of the incidence and the mortality, all these things we've gone over. So in a community-based participatory research approach, I started working with African American women in developing what has been called the Witness Project. And this was in 1991. This tagline about in church people witness to save souls, and the Witness Project, they witness to save lives. And these were actual survivors and less likely to talk about their cancer experiences than most white women. And so the idea that they could do this and talk about this in a faith-based environment, in their churches, in community organizations, kind of with the whole spirituality included in it, had proved to be a very effective mechanism. And we're still using this narrative communication process. In fact, we've talked about it even with clinical trials and in other things, that hearing from somebody like you that's experienced something, whether it's a research clinical trial that they participated in, or screening, or something else, it can be pretty effective. So this did show increase in breast self-examination, increase in mammograms, and this is before we had the CDC program to fund free mammography for uninsured women, so it was pretty significant results. We transcreated this for another program for Hispanic women, called Esperanza y Vida, which means life and hope, because there were significant problems with Latinas as well, both from multiple areas, multiple Latin American countries, as far as use of mammography and Pap tests. And it did vary. As you can see, it varied by whether someone is from Mexico versus Cubans, and Puerto Ricans had much higher. Of course, they also have much higher access. Puerto Ricans have much more, especially when we started this study. So it's very similar to the Witness Project, been very effective. But it's interesting, this was a randomized intervention, and the control program was a diabetes program. So we went out and did a breast cancer program, did the diabetes program, wondering if the message itself would make a very big difference in this. And these were randomized in Arkansas, with primarily a Mexican population of immigrant women, New York City, which was very diverse, had Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Mexican, and then here in Buffalo, we had primarily Puerto Rican women. We used the audience response system. Y'all have used those in your classes where you have the little remote and you answer questions, and it worked great to be able to, and you have to read the question. For this population, we'd read the question and Spanish, because a lot of folks are not very high literacy in Spanish or English, and then they could answer it Everybody knows how to use a remote. It's great. So, and it's also automatic data collection. You just download it. So it's a very interesting way to get survey data at a community level. We had a 2-month follow-up, and then at 2 months, if they had not been screened, then we called back at 8 months and offered navigation. So we did focus on newer immigrants, Spanish-speaking, and the results was very interesting. The cancer knowledge did not increase screening. In other words, the women that participated in the diabetes program were as likely to get screened as the ones that participated in the cancer. So it wasn't the cancer knowledge, it wasn't the, which we argue a lot about, that it's a lot more than just what you know, it has to be something else. But the influential factors were actually the outreach with the women. Many of these women had never had a program, especially in the rural areas, had never had anybody come to them and talk to them about any of these topics. We did have written materials and things about stuff, but it was the ones with that were navigated after the 2 months that everybody wanted help. Everybody wanted to get into screening for anything. So that was much more important as cultural brokers. And the navigation program now, we also have a navigation program that we have started here in the breast clinic here at Roswell to try to provide better services and support for women. The New York sites, the Puerto Rican women were more likely to be screened. We have a really high rate here in Buffalo. More seeing this negative impact of the socio-political conservatism in the South. And during this time we were doing this study, was actually during part of the time that Huckabee was governor of Arkansas, and there was a major INS raid of several chicken factories, and they rounded up about 40 undocumented Mexican immigrants and were trying to deport them. And all of those people that they rounded up also had children that were born in the U.S. And actually, Huckabee kind of stepped in and helped that a little bit. But during that process, the women in Arkansas, we had such challenges with the intervention because the women didn't want to go out anymore. Nobody wanted to go out, even to the church, to do a program. We started doing programs in people's homes, which was really interesting. But I think also we had an experience with a woman, not one of the women in our study, but the story of a woman going for health care in a local community health clinic and somebody kind of reporting her as not having a Social Security number or undocumented or something. So there's a lot of issues related to that that impacted that we, of course, couldn't control. Lung cancer. So as you probably know, we have a fairly active lung cancer screening program now, especially since the information has come out about the effectiveness of screening and improving survival for smokers and former smokers. The lung cancer incidence is kind of a disparity issue because African-American men have a higher rate, even though they smoke less, and the incidence in Western New York is significantly higher. The mortality rate is also higher, and we're not sure exactly what's going on with that, and there's a lot of research going on about that. The high-risk lung cancer here, they do a spiral CT, bronchoscopy, and then they also, in the bronchoscopy, they can remove premalignant lesions and do tissue samples and look at this and follow them up. And in the process of doing this, one of the problems was they had over 400 patients in the registry, but only 4% were African American. So nobody could do anything of studies with these two, like a case control or comparison with African Americans and white patients, because we haven't had enough and we still don't have enough. But we did a pilot that did address this. We worked with some of the high-risk groups, like firefighters happen to be high-risk for lung cancer, plus a lot of them smoke, and community recruitment. So we had 496 folks. And out of that, had a very good rate of minority. We had 16% Native American, 19% African American, and a lot of former smokers, current smokers. We those were the numbers of what we actually got screened, were those percentages. So we actually screened about 80 people, which is really pretty good. In this study, Jewels in Our Genes is a very interesting example of community-based participatory research. It's actually a genetic epidemiology study, because this was, the PI on this is Heather Ox-Balcom at UB. I don't know if any of you all were at UB or know her, but my role with her was as a connector and to help her put this piece together. But as you all probably know, the Mary Claire King story, the BRCA 1 and 2 story, that with 125 families, all white, that she had figured out how to identify this, the BRCA 1 gene. Somebody else then worked on the BRCA 2. And 96% of those mutations are actually, the carriers are white women. And as you know, it's also a very high carrier rate in Ashkenazi Jewish white women. But nobody had done anything about this with African American women. And there are, why haven't we done that? So African American and black women in the U.S. have this higher incidence of premenopausal breast cancer, like the triple negatives. Could that be genetic? And higher breast cancer mortality rates than white women. And I think, of course, Marie's working on that with Dr. Yao and Amber Soni on trying to look at her samples, and I have some more on that. So one of the issues in doing this, and it's interesting because when we see something like this and we see differences that might be genetic or might be something else, even with the issues of biospecimen donations, it's a very fine line between studies that are perceived by individuals and patients as being exploitative versus not being included. So with clinical trials, we really need to make sure we do include everybody and that folks are included in a representative manner, but at the same time that folks don't feel exploited. And this is a real challenge for example, particularly the Seneca Nation around here. Everybody knows about the Havasupai and the Arizona and using samples for things they weren't supposed to be using it for and turned into a real disaster. So in all of these kinds of studies, that's an issue. But in this particular example, Veronica Meadows-Ray, the lady in the center, is here in Buffalo. Her aunt and her mother on either side. I knew her mother through the Witness Project. Her mother was a volunteer with us in the intervention with the Witness Project and was actively involved. And one day, I had not been here for about 2 years, so it must have been about 2008. Veronica's calling, her mother calls us. She's all upset. She's had a breast biopsy, and she's got breast cancer. So we, of course, get her into being seen here at Roswell. And in this whole process, we were doing a photo shoot of, and found out that we knew that her mother had had breast cancer, but we didn't know about her aunt and the other four people in her family with breast cancer. And in doing this photo shoot for Minority Cancer Awareness Month week, which is coming up in April, I was talking to Veronica, and I said, well, gosh, and she said, oh, well, these are only two. I have all these other relatives with breast cancer. And I said, well, surely you did the genetic testing. And she said, well, of course I did. I thought it's got to be in my family. So they did the testing, and, of course, she was not a BRCA1 or 2 carrier, and neither were the other relatives in her family. So she asked me, she says, you know, what's going on here? Why don't y'all do research on figuring out what's the genetic factor in my family? Because it's obviously, there has to be some linkages here. And you know, we haven't. So I talked to Heather Ox-Balcom because I knew she had been trained in family linkages. She's at UB, but she does very similar molecular and genetic epi work, but she does focus on families. She said, well, surely somebody's done that already. So she did this huge lit review. We talked to Christine Ambersoni. We talked to lots of other people. And they hadn't. Nobody had done it because they didn't think they could get the families together to do this study. So we started working together, and she put in this grant to Komen. It was a disparities career development grant. She was an early stage investigator. This genome-wide linkage analysis to look for the novel genes with African-American women. We recruited, we needed to recruit at least 125 relative pairs, total of at least 250 cases, 336 women. So we did this partnership with the National Witness Project, because the Witness Project that I started in Arkansas, there's a site here in Buffalo. They're in 20 other states. We have a network of people, and we've been working with them and used several other things. The Susan Love Avon Army of Women, you all may be familiar with that. If you're needing to recruit women for breast cancer research, you can do these e-blasts, and we recruited quite a few people in that. I'll show you the numbers from that. So between 2009 and 2012, we recruited a total of 342 African-American women from around the United States, 248 affected, 94 siblings, and 127 families. They did a spit, they did an origin kit, they filled out the stuff, and all the women that had breast cancer, she got tumor samples. And then in terms of looking at what worked, of course, the Witness Project itself had a very high yield, and we had a lot of women to call on. Other studies, Dr. Ambrosoni, Dr. Palmer, other people that had large groups of black women with breast cancer, we sent out letters to them. Many of them wanted to participate in this as well. The e-blast from the Army of Women, other conferences where Witness Project women went, et cetera, and were able to do this. And so now she's in the process. She has an R01 pending to do some more. She did find some additional genetic links that look to be associated or close to the chromosome where BRCA 1 and 2 are, but they're not the same, so we'll see what happens. She has to do her next steps. The next study I wanted to just mention is Dr. Ambrosoni's PL1, because it is directly related to what we're talking about in terms of social determinants of breast cancer as well as the biology. So in Dr. Ambrosoni's findings from her PL1, she's resubmitted it, but her first one, was this huge issue of parity. And we traditionally tell women, you know, having children before 30, having more children, younger, et cetera, reduces your risk of breast cancer. Well, in this largest number, and Marie, you've got I think it's about 3,000 black, 3 to 5, how many total in that sample? Now it's over 8,000. It was about 5,000, so it's over 8,000. So it's the largest sample of black women with breast cancer in the United States. And so the AMBER Consortium realized in their results that parity, formerly considered risk, actually increases the risk of triple negative breast cancer in African American women. So the women that were having babies at 19 and having 3 babies before age 25 or 30 were the ones that were at highest risk for breast cancer. Related to that, these breast cancer risks could be totally ameliorated. They went away in the women who breastfed. So, unfortunately, breastfeeding rates are socially constructed also, and black women are less likely to breastfeed. They're also more likely to have children at a younger age. So these social and biological process that's going on here is creating a significant risk for triple negative breast cancers in these women. So this is a major finding, I think, from the work that is going forward in Dr. Ambrosoni's lab. And I have been collaborating with her on this. We now have pending R21 to do an effectiveness study on seeing if we can actually increase breastfeeding by African American women, working with the WIC program. So we'll see, and whether or not knowing this information, that this messaging, we know knowledge isn't everything, but we're thinking that this information is not just knowledge, that it may impact risk perceptions so that women may be more likely to try breastfeeding. And we don't know how long somebody has to breastfeed to reduce their risk. So perhaps even doing it for a couple of months will make a difference. We'll see. So, summary of the things, importance of cultural tailoring and approach. You heard about this from all of Dr. Rodriguez and then the beginning of the things we were talking about. Sensitivity to variations in communities, the importance of local culture. It does make a big difference. We saw that certainly in the Esperanza Vida, the differences in the various Latina groups that we worked with. Messaging communication is sensitive to all of these variations, all of these things. And we just take for granted kind of that everybody sees things through the same glasses that we have on. And how many of you all wear glasses or contacts? Okay. Yeah, me too. And I don't know if you remember, but the first time that you put on glasses, you know, when you were in, if you were young, like I was, and you were in school, and you saw things, and things were kind of blurry up there, and you thought, well, everybody sees like this. And then when you realize that not everybody sees that way, and you put on glasses for the first time, it's like, oh, I can see the individual leaves on the tree. That's what I really remember about that. And it's actually the very same thing for a lot of other people. We just kind of assume that folks see things the same way we do, and that's not the case. And so it's very important for us to improve our messaging and communication in healthcare and in recruitment of individuals, as we've heard, so that we can accommodate for that. Direct education, particularly for low literacy groups and for older people. Direct education is much more effective and oftentimes more meaningful, and they remember it, they understand it, than giving them something to read, telling them to watch a video or what. Now you can have somebody watch a video. Video can be very meaningful, but you still need some of that direct communication to set it up and have them to be there. And particularly also for a direct education, it's very important for anyone that's not comfortable with the system, immigrant, refugees, et cetera. This is very time and labor intensive, as Dr. Rodriguez has said also. The work to recruit the African-American families for the Jewels in Our Genes study took twice as long as we thought it would be. It took a lot more resources, and it took a lot of direct phone calls with people. The medical mistrust, we talked about that. And finally, one of the main things is there's a kind of a tendency, and not as much now, I think, as it used to be, but certainly over the years, with, oh, somebody comes in with a late-stage cancer. Somebody comes in and they didn't get their mammogram. Somebody didn't get their colonoscopy. Somebody didn't. Tendency to blame the victim. Even people that don't have health insurance now, people are saying, well, it's out there, they can get it, blah, blah. There are a lot of factors that happen with people's lives and are social determinants for their behavior and what's going on. And there are systems issues that are many times much more important than what the individual can deal with. And so I hate to see people blame the victim. All right, I have lots of people I want to, I have, and we both have. So, questions? Yeah. You have, oh, I thought you had a finger. I saw a finger. Okay, well, I guess we're done. If you do have any questions, you feel free to come up and ask us.